Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of The Genius of Impeachment. You can learn more at thenation.com, and you can follow John on Twitter at Nichols Uprising. Nichols is N-I-C-H-O-L-S. At Nichols Uprising. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, just about anywhere there's a podcast. Apple Podcasts, Podomatic, SoundCloud, you name it. And at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, a plug for participation. Here's some organizations, some websites that you can go to if you want to work toward the legislation, the movement, the election, all of that. Indivisible.org. MoveOn.org. MoveOn's been around since way back in Clinton's time, but MoveOn, which had been primarily digital, has aligned itself much more with the grassroots, and that's one word, MoveOn.org. That's a national organization. And in California, we have CourageCampaign.org, which basically is the same sort of thing, digital, but aligned with the grassroots. Two that are very specific to activism are 5calls.org. That's the number 5 and the word C-A-L-L-S. 5calls, one word, .org. And that tells you the most relevant and timely calls you can make to your representatives. Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com. Tells you when your representatives are going to be holding meetings, open meetings in your area when they're home, and you can go and speak to them, in person, townhallprojectoneword.com. And finally, because climate change is the existential threat we face, 350.org, which is the large national organization working on that. Now to today's guest, John Nichols. One of the things that I value about John is that while he is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, he's also associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. So his beat includes Wisconsin's capital as well as The Nation's. So who better to turn to about what needs to happen so that Wisconsin and the rest of the Rust Belt don't deliver for Trump in 2020? But it turns out John is also the author, as I mentioned before, of the book The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. So turns out we've got at least a couple of things to talk about. Nichols co-authored a number of books with Robert McChesney, including The Death and Life of American Journalism and Our Media, Not Theirs, The Democratic Struggle Against Corporate Media. He edited Against the Beast, a documentary history of American opposition to empire. Authored several books, including his most recent was Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And he's also a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and the host of Next Left, The Nation's podcast that features rising progressive politicians. Welcome again, John Nichols, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
It's such a pleasure to be with you, my friend.
Let me tell listeners that we're recording this conversation Tuesday, November 12th. And as you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we'll talk about. So I mentioned you're associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, contributor to The Progressive, also in Madison, and In These Times, headquartered in Chicago. What is it about the Midwest and about you and the Midwest that it seems so much a part of not just who you were as you grew up, but who you still are?
I'm an absurdly Midwestern person by any measure. There is snow on the ground as we speak, and I am thrilled by that. In fact, I come from this place. My ancestors started coming here in the 1820s as tin miners out of Cornwall who had, they were economic refugees trying to find more mines to work, and they found lead mines in southwest Wisconsin. And most of my relatives were in this state before statehood, back to the 1830s, 1840s. So, it's what I know. It's what I like. I also think, and I'm in Washington a lot. I'm in New York in a day or so, and so they plan to travel. But what's really important is that if you're going to cover national affairs, I know there have to be people in Washington all the time. I totally recognize that. But if we're serious about national affairs, there's also a value to being outside of Washington, to being far from it and, you know, interacting on a regular basis with folks who will tell you what they're interested in, what issues matter to them, what's real to them. And that often is different than what you'll hear in Washington. So I like being out here in the middle of the country.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, you in a previous interview, you told the story actually about becoming a reporter for the Union Grove newspaper at the age of 10, and let us know that one way that that happened was that Union Grove had a population of 970.
That's right. I was 971, so there was room for a young journalist. But you know, this is actually not an unheard of thing. It was funny. I was giving a speech in North Dakota last weekend, and the guy who was moderated an interview with me afterwards had started on his dad's radio station, you know, over in Moorhead, around Moorhead, Minnesota, or north of it a little bit, you know, at 10, 11, something like that. A lot of people are drawn to journalism. It historically, and I think still for some folks, has been a romantic field, you know, one where perhaps you don't make a great fortune, but you have this remarkable opportunity to travel in all these interesting circles and sometimes even to ask difficult questions of the powerful.
That's right, which most citizens do not ever have that opportunity.
Well, they don't have enough opportunity,
yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there is, and that, I guess that takes us full circle to much of what we'll talk about.
Right.
But it's also a duty that goes with being a journalist, right? At least I think that it's a wonderful opportunity. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. But, you know, the duty that goes with it is that, you know, when you're I guess the best way to put it is this. Power can be very intoxicating. Wealth can be very intoxicating. And for a lot of folks, when you move in circles of the powerful and the wealthy, it becomes, you know, very easy to sort of become a part of that or at least become deferent to it. It is the job of the journalist to kind of walk into those spaces and not become intoxicated, to not be deferent, and to, you know, ask billionaires why they want to run for president. And if they don't have a good reason, treat them the same as you would anybody else.
Right, right. Yes, I mean, we know that not sickness, but that temptation to fear for future access and thus, you know, rub the edges off of your interviews so that you don't turn them against you. You know, ask the questions, but stay on their good side.
Oh, yeah, we see that all the time. You know, obviously in the celebrity interview, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also in, you know, just it happens a lot in politics. I don't really think it's because journalists are being deferent either. Sometimes it's just the journalists are overwhelmed. They've got so many things going on, and so it's easier to do sort of a softer conversation. You have to do a lot of research. You have to think a lot about things to ask tough questions. And that's one of the reasons why Bob McChesney and I have written so much over the years about the need to provide proper funding for journalism so that working reporters have the resources and the time to prepare to ask those really tough questions.
Thank you for that, John, because I think I fell into what I think is the normal thing, which is to berate the journalist. But what you're pointing out is that all this stuff that we've seen over the last few years of the cutting of staffs and the all of that at the national journals, at the leading newspapers, and on, puts them in a predicament where you're right. When you're gonna challenge someone, you have to be ready to deal with that challenge, and maybe they don't have the time and resources to do that. Thank you for that. That puts a different light on it. Let's talk about, you wrote an article for The Nation titled Tuesday's Election Could Be a Second Blue Wave. November 5th was that election day, of local elections primarily, state and local, in which you said we could look for signals about voters' feelings at what is a fairly unique moment in our political history. What were you looking for, and what did you learn?
Well, I happen to be of the school that says Tip O'Neill was wrong. I don't believe all politics is local. I think that, especially with our changing media system and campaign finance, a lot of other structural realities, local elections and state elections, even in an off-year setting, can tell us a lot about national politics. They can tell us where things are, where they're headed. They identify issues, and this cycle that we just went through and identified a whole bunch of issues, real significant stuff going on criminal justice reform in some key communities like San Francisco, where Chesa Boudin was elected district attorney, a very significant win for somebody backing major criminal justice reform. They also tell us a lot about money in politics. Amazon tried to weigh into the Seattle City Council elections, moved a lot of money in, and pretty much got beat. In fact, even got beat by a socialist,
yeah,
Shama Sawant. And so that's instructive. But I'm not in the camp that says, pop the champagne corks because big money got beat. I happen to be in the camp that says, yeah, it's great that big money gets beat, but be aware, the thing about big money is it comes back. It's like the vampire in every, yeah, Dracula film. It never really disappears, or rarely does. And so that's instructive. But the biggest thing I took away from these elections, of course, was the indications that Donald Trump has indeed done serious damage to the Republican brand. This is the third major election night since he became president. Donald Trump became president at the start of 2017. You had the November elections of 2017. Major progress for Democrats in New Jersey, Virginia, other states, in a lot of suburban areas. You had the midterm elections of 2018. Major progress for Democrats. They took back the U.S. House of Representatives, won a lot of key governorships, a lot of significant progress for them. Now, the third of these, the off-year elections of 2019. Again, major progress for the Democrats. They won the governorship of Kentucky, apparently. Very close election, but narrow win there. They took control of both houses of the Virginia state legislature. And, again, at that sort of next level down, you saw really big shifts in the suburbs of Philadelphia, a key swing state, the suburbs of Indianapolis, another key potential swing state, mm-hmm, Indiana,
yeah,
tougher one, but still there. And so the bottom line is that I look for all of that. And frankly, a lot of what I saw on the November 2018 result page, if you will.
Oh, you're talking, November 2019.
2019, I apologize. Even I'm mixing my elections off. 18 was positive. 19 was pretty positive.
Right. And let me just go back to the Kentucky governorship, because you wrote an article about how the Trump sought to weaponize impeachment as a political tool. He headlines a rally in Lexington the evening before the election with Mitch McConnell at his side. He basically begs Kentuckians to save his presidency, that if Bashir wins and Bevin loses, it looks bad for me and we're doomed and so on. But he even goes so far as to say Bashir doesn't represent you. He represents the Washington swamp. He's backed by the same people trying to overthrow the last election, reference to the impeachment. The timing is meaningful. Dems had gone for impeachment just days before, had formally gone for impeachment. Reflections on that one?
Oh, yeah. I think this is the big deal. It's quite fascinating because, remember, you have to have a little history here. Nancy Pelosi and a lot of other top Democrats, I would argue most of the top Democrats in leadership in Congress, as well as just about every Democratic strategist, and frankly, just about every pundit who appears on, CNN or wherever, right? They're all like, oh, impeachment's the third rail. If you touch it, you're going to die politically. It's just going to be horrible. You can't can't even think about impeachment.
Because
don't let it pass through your head.
Right, because right. It would activate his base so much to rise up that they would would be overwhelming.
That's right. It's so dangerous. You just don't even. Yeah, it's like some sort of, you know, like alchemy that you don't want to mess with. Because
the ring.
You know, exactly. Yeah. Touching this part of the Constitution is too dangerous. It's too electrified. Well, we just got a real-time experiment in it. The Democrats literally voted to launch an impeachment inquiry, a formal inquiry. And then a couple days later, you've got an election in a very... Republican-leaning state, a state that Trump won by 30 points in the last election. Trump were a state where Republicans control most of the statewide offices. They got the legislature. You know, they're incredibly powerful there in Kentucky. Historically, it was a competitive state, but it's really shifted a lot. And so here you have this gubernatorial election, and it's all on the, you know, there it is. I mean, it's fully nationalized, at least in Trump's eyes, right? It's all about impeachment. It's all about stop the Democrats, again, in a state that Trump won by 30% in 2016. And the incumbent Republican governor, who, by the way, was a jerk.
Yeah.
And, you know, not a great guy, but the incumbent Republican governor gets beat. And he gets beat by a relatively kind of center-left moderate to moderately liberal candidate, who, by the way, did run pro-choice, pro-union, pro-public education. Certainly, you know, not some conservative Democrat, you know, kind of a middle-of-the-road guy. But somebody who didn't talk about impeachment. I'm not trying to create a fantasy
that both sides were talking about impeachment, yeah.
They weren't. But here's the bottom line on it all. The thing you take away is impeachment didn't become a third rail.
Right.
It didn't.
You point out that in Columbus, Indiana, Vice President Mike Pence's hometown, Democrats took control of the city council for the first time in more than three decades. I kind of like that one.
Oh, and there's more. There's actually, I mean, just keep it in Kentucky for a second. And Columbus, Indiana is, by the way, a very, very good measure because that's, you know, a mid-sized city. That's really where a lot of our national elections are decided because they're decided at the, you know your urban areas are going to vote pretty Democratic. You know that your rural areas tend to be a little more Republican. It's these mid-sized cities that you've got a lot of play in. And so that's a big one. But let me give you one other one, and that is that in Kentucky, and this was fascinating, roughly 20 counties that voted for Donald Trump in 2016 voted for the Democrat, Andy Beshear, when Donald Trump was saying, you got to stick with me. Right, mm. you have to vote my way. Beshear would not be on his way to becoming governor if he hadn't carried those 20 counties. Certainly, he had a great urban turnout. Certainly, he did a little better in the suburbs than Democrats have done. But this rural shift—I mean, that's critical to make this thing work. And let me give you an example of how extreme it is because I'm a geek, and I always watch one county in Kentucky, Elliott County. It's a little county in eastern Kentucky. You know, in the region sometimes referred to as coal country, but it's a mix of elements in its economy, but very rural, small town. Elliott County gave Trump I hope I'm right on this, it's within a point or so, gave him, Trump, a 70-26 victory. So he won by over 50. What am I talking about here? Yeah, over 40 points, 44 points in 2016. On election day 2019, Andy Beshear won that county by 59-39.
Wow.
And I'm not that good at math.
Yeah.
But it's looking like over a 60-point swing.
Yeah.
In one county.
Yeah. Now, one thing I want to point out, and then we're going to move off Kentucky, but that one of the things that you didn't mention that Beshear was for and Bibbin was against was Medicaid and the help for it, because Kentucky had been among the red states. Kentucky, up until Bevin got into office, had been doing very well with the Affordable Care Act. They were kind of a state that was doing a good job. He kind of stopped that in his tracks, and I think that was kind of a simmering issue underneath a lot of this.
Maybe. Oh, I think it's a huge issue. And, you know, of course, Bashir's dad had been the governor, right?
Yeah.
So he was associated with all this. And it was a fascinating thing because, you know, the way that they sold, you know, a step toward national health care in very conservative Kentucky was the radical act of renaming it.
Ah.
They just called it something else.
Really?
Basically.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds so Republican.
Well, but in this case, it was done, you know, for the forces of humanity.
Yeah. No, no, I'm glad to hear it. Yeah.
Yeah. And just to give you an example of it, you know, you remember that polling they did where they said, do you like Obamacare? And people said, oh, no, I'm not too big a fan of that. And they say, do you like the Affordable Care Act? Oh, yeah, I like Affordable Care.
Right.
You know,
so. Right.
Anyway, Kentucky, it's a complexity here. But one of the things that I always emphasize is that these off-year elections, midterm elections, whatever, you know, whatever cycle you happen to be in, you want to take a good, close look at them. You want to dig down deep because they usually tell you at least a little bit about where you're going. And what this tells me is, just from looking at the 2019 cycle, impeachment becomes far more likely because of this cycle. And the potential, not the certainty by any means, but the potential that a few Republicans in the Senate, more likely than the House, but a few Republicans might break loose and oppose Trump becomes greater.
Yes.
Because they look at these numbers.
Yeah. In other words, that intimidation factor that the Democrats were scared, but the Republicans were in lockstep. And that possibility that, whoa, maybe it'll work differently Election Day 2020 than I'd been thinking is at play. We're going to talk a lot about impeachment, and obviously we're already, but I do want to talk a little bit more about some of this stuff. And one thing I'm curious about that is you host a podcast, Next Left, which I didn't know about a long time ago, but have learned about. What is it? How did it happen? And what are you learning there? Because that's a look at the grassroots and the future.
Yeah, that's a really fun thing. I mean, you know, look, I'm not some big smart radio guy like you. I tend to work in print, and then I go on radio shows, and I sometimes TV shows, and I'll talk, right?
Right.
You know, But actually hosting something where you're working with a brilliant producer, and we have a fabulous producer on the show who really does tremendous lifting, and other people who are, you know, back it up in all sorts of ways. So, you know, I emphasize that only to say that, you know, I don't begin to claim super skills here. But I've had a chance over the last roughly year to interview most of the rising stars on the left in American politics, you know, and I've people like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and Ro Khanna and Premier Jayapal and, you know, Tiffany Caban, who ran for DA out in New York, Chesa Boudin, who was just elected DA in San Francisco, judges, city council members, you know, all sorts of folks, mostly people who've won their elections. We do talk to a few people who've lost. But primarily it's people who've won. And it's really about how generally, as younger figures or as newcomers to politics, they are trying to frame out a different politics, a more, frankly, for lack of a better term, a more militant politics, a more aggressive, progressive politics. And a lot of people we talk to are democratic socialists. A lot of them are, you know, progressive. Some are independents. Some are mostly Democrats. It's been a fascinating thing, and what I come away with is this. A couple things that are really important. Number one, I don't think that our national pundits have any idea how powerful Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign was as an inspiration to young people to run for office. I mean, it's a big, big deal. An awful lot of the people we talked to, not everyone by any means, but a lot of the people we talked to literally said, yeah, I worked on the Sanders campaign. It turned me on to, you know, all kinds of ideas. It turned me on to electoral politics as something that really could have meaning. And they ran and won. And well, I'm talking about legislators, judges, you know, members of Congress.
Yeah. One thing I would imagine is that let's say that you like you and I do, think quite a bit like Bernie. Well, you would look and you would go, there's no party I can run in. Because you kind of look at the centrist Democrats and then he runs, it galvanizes people. So it's not only maybe you had the experience of being in a crowd of 25,000 at a college stadium hearing him, but you suddenly said, wait a minute, this can happen in one of the two parties.
Yeah. And in fact, I did exactly see that. And I saw that he won the better part of 24 elections across the country, or 2000, or what am I saying?
Yeah.
He won the better part of
20
some caucuses and primaries.
Yeah.
And so suddenly this is real. And,
yeah.
And he didn't do so as some slick, you know, character. He did so as, you know, 70 something democratic socialist from a very rural state of New England. It suggested that you can break some of the rules, right? You can push the boundaries.
Yeah.
You can do things differently. And I just can't begin to tell you how much I've learned from doing the podcast. The other thing I've learned is you have no idea. And I know you're smart on top of all this, and your listeners are smarter than we are. But I cannot begin to emphasize how huge this criminal justice reform thing is and how it is driving a whole lot of different and better politics at the local, state, and potentially even national level. There's a lot going on out there, and there are people winning judgeships and winning prosecutors' positions who really, you know, not only do they believe in addressing mass incarceration and you know, cash bond and all these, or cash bail and all these other things, but they're actually changing it. It's amazing.
Well, that is something I mean, that is wonderful. And my guess, I had no idea of what you just said. And my guess is, you know, it's not in the conversation that much. So until you start talking to these people, you know, you probably didn't know how big a factor it was either.
Oh, no. Well, I knew it was, you know, we set these interviews up, right?
Yeah.
So you knew there were people doing things and stuff, and that's interesting. I read, pick up a magazine.
Yeah.
But when you do these, and these are relatively in-depth interviews, we talk to people for about a half hour.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we'll talk to them for an hour, and it gets cut,
cut the good parts out.
You know?
Yeah.
What's fascinating is that in talking to them, you start to realize how poorly, except by some operations like The Appeal and others that are doing a great job, but how poorly most of our media has covered sort of a sea change on drug law, bail issues, mass incarceration. And I talked to a guy, a judge down in Houston, and this guy just literally blew me away. Young guy, he's in his 30s, a Democratic socialist. He got himself elected to a judgeship. In Houston, they elect like so many judges, you can't begin to count them. It's like L.A.
Or
any other big city. So he gets himself elected to a judgeship, and he's got, you know, you're a new judge, you have kind of the lousy shift, right? You're judging at night or early in the morning or whatever, and it's the cases of people that get picked up for whatever violation. In a matter of months, they shifted the system so that they didn't have a whole bunch of people, you know, jammed in a cage overnight. You know, essentially they said, yeah, you don't have the money to, you know, meet your bail. Here's your basic standards. You know, we're going to move beyond bail. We're going to, you know, say you need to show up and blah, blah, blah. And so they've implemented great big reforms in Houston, Texas.
Yeah, it's fabulous. Without legislation or an initiative or anything, just executively within the judiciary.
Well, this is another thing I'm learning. And again, we're here to talk about all sorts of stuff, but this is really interesting.
No, I mean, when I have a chance, as we are right now, to talk about things other people aren't talking about, I'm interested.
Well, this is really cool. So I was learning from this guy, you know, actually not just him, from several judges we've interviewed and prosecutors and that, is there's an immense amount of discretion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you get elected to a judgeship, and you're seeing all these people sitting in jail or sitting in a cage overnight because they're not rich, right? They don't have the money to just bail themselves out. Well, the judges can kind of get together and say, this is inefficient. This isn't realistic. they meet with the cops. They, you know, have a discussion. They think, hey, you know, what do you think? Maybe we just tell them they got to show up, right? Like you would to a rich person.
Yes.
You know, quite often. And you know what? The people they were putting in these cages show up.
Yeah, sure. Exactly.
They do. They don't want it. They don't want to, you know, end up in a worse problem.
That's right. That's right. And it's a bigger crime not showing up usually.
Right. So anyway, bottom line is you just learn so many things.
So let's tell listeners, how do they find Next Left? Because my guess is some people are going to be interested now.
I hope they are. And today, and by the way, we just put up today's podcast. You know, I know we're taping ahead, but this week's podcast, I'll say in whatever way we do, which is a extended interview, not with a newcomer, but with Barbara Lee, the congresswoman from the Bay Area, because so many of these young political figures coming up have cited her as a hero. So we said, okay, well, let's dig back into that. And man, this Barbara Lee interview, it's incredible. I mean, she's such a brilliant member, as I think most of your listeners will know, and very consistent over decades. But boy, she was telling stories about as a young woman involved with the Black Panthers and their food programs and how she got drawn into Shirley Chisholm's campaign. And, you know, it was her political journey.
Wow.
And interestingly, it parallels a lot of what we're now, different names, but it parallels a lot of what we're now seeing with this new generation coming up, often involved in pretty militant politics, very doubtful of the system, drawn in by somebody that they respect in Barbara Lee's circumstance, Shirley Chisholm, and then having an amazing career in politics, which with Barbara Lee continues to this day. And so you can find all this great stuff, which, you know, I would tell you it makes a fine holiday gift, but I think it's free, at www.thenation.com, and you just look at Next Left. It's there.
Very good. My guess is if you go to a podcast site, you just look
for Next Left. Yeah, you can go to all of them.
And just look for Next Left. Okay, so it's interesting. We're at the halfway point, so I'm going to tell people that this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, author in 2006 of The Genius of Impeachment, where he was being prescient and telling us what we would need to know 13 years later. And you can learn more at thenation.com, including looking at Next Left, his podcast. And you can follow John on Twitter at Nichols Uprising. Let me just jump from that one to one that links to that, which is last May you wrote about the backlash to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee's plan to punish insurgent Democrats for backing primary challengers to incumbents. Their notion was that if a vendor, that is someone who sold advertising, someone who did consulting, someone who did anything in the campaign work, if you worked for someone challenging a Democratic incumbent, you would not get any contracts with the DCCC. Am I correct that that's what they were proposing? How did folks react, and where do we stand today? Because it really relates to what we were just talking about.
Totally it does, and it's still something, it's still a place of great wrangling and difficulty. It hasn't worked very well. There's a tremendous number of challengers to incumbents stepping up because that's the era we're in. You saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have this incredible breakthrough politically. And frankly, there's a lot of other people saying, you know,
why not me?
I want to try that, right? And so the attempt to shut this down hasn't been too successful. But it's still the DCCC and a lot of these Democratic groups are very resistant to challenges to incumbents. In fact, on Next Left, we've even interviewed some of these young candidates, mostly young women who have been stepping up to make these runs. And they're not intimidated because sort of a new infrastructure has developed to support outsider candidates and endorsements are being made. I think the process is opening up. But one of the things I wanted to emphasize is how hypocritical and how cynical this is. And just for a simple reason, and that is, you know, you ask yourself a couple of historical questions. How did Ron Dellums, really one of the greatest advocates for peace ever to serve in Congress, how did he get there? He beat a Democratic incumbent in 1970. How did Bella Abzug, one of the pioneering, really amazing feminist members of Congress, somebody, again, who, you know, broke things open and really changed a lot of our politics. How did she get elected? She beat an incumbent. How did Elizabeth Holtzman, who's still around talking to folks about impeachment, critical member of the Watergate panel back in 1974, how did she get elected? She beat an incumbent. The fact of the matter is, this is nothing new. Many of our greatest members of Congress have beaten incumbents. And so instead of, you know, freaking out about it or, you know, trying to stop it, why not get comfortable with the reality that if an incumbent's doing a great job, as an example, Barbara Lee, they're not going to have a hard time getting reelected. If an incumbent is not doing a great job, if they're not remaining in contact with their district sufficiently, they may get beat. That's healthy. And the Democratic Party ought to wrap its head around that. Or it's going to end up, you know, in some fights that it really ultimately doesn't want to be in.
Well, and let's look at it this way. If your incumbent is vulnerable to a Democratic challenge, it's not that unlikely, unless the district is completely safe, that they're vulnerable to a Republican opponent. Better they lose to an up-and-coming progressive insurgent Democrat than to a Republican.
Totally, right? I mean, you know, think about this. And the Republicans, to their immense credit, they kind of understand this, right?
Yeah, look at the Tea Party, right?
That's exactly right. And maybe we don't like that. You know, you always get these people who say, oh, I wish politics would just be in the center, and I wish it could go back to being really boring and no one cares, right? Well, that's not the era we live in. We're in a different media era. There's a lot of realities there. And one of the things is, again, whether you like it or not, the Republican Party has moved dramatically to the right. It has not had a sufficient counterbalance in the Democratic Party. And so now we're seeing something where the Democratic Party is becoming a more progressive party. The Republican Party, obviously stuck in the ditch it's driven into. That creates a politics that's going to be real, whether you like it or not. And maybe a centrist party will step in there. I don't know. But it's very unlikely. And so I think we're going to have some left-right fights. And, you know, I happen to believe the Democrats will do better in those left-right fights if they're clearly defined on the left.
Yes. And I mean, I've been reading a lot of what you've been writing recently and about how the Democrats can win back Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio. And it's very much that. And so let's just, I mean, it's crazy. We've gone this far and we haven't really talked about impeachment, but hell, everybody's talking about impeachment. Well, but let me make that my last non-impeachment question is your recipe, your advice to the Democrats to make sure that those states, which will decide the 2020 presidential election, don't deliver a second Trump term.
Sure. My lesson is very, very simple. Do everything, right? You know, I hear these people say, we've just got to focus on economics and not on identity. And I think that's absurd because I want everybody who is ready to vote for change because they feel our economic system is unjust. But I also want everybody to come vote who feels that our social system is unjust or that we have genuine structural racism affecting our economics, our criminal justice system, a host of other, you know, measures that we make. And so, you know, I am always uncomfortable with those who try to say, oh, there's one easy route in. There's one way to win. It's not true. It never has been. And nobody serious, I think, gets lost in that. They recognize over time that you have to be welcoming to folks who are coming for different reasons without compromising your principles because you need clarity. And this is there's always challenges there. And, but to my mind, I think the Kentucky example we were talking about before is an interesting one, not because Andy Beshear down in Kentucky is some big leftist. He isn't, and I'm not trying to suggest that. But he did some things this time that were really interesting. Fully embraced the unions. I mean, he was all down with the unions, no question whatsoever. Now, Kentucky, that's not that dangerous a move because it does have some union tradition, but teachers' unions, you know, all sorts of industrial unions, he was down with them. Number two, embraced abortion rights. Now, in states like Kentucky, that hasn't always been the case. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's still some Southern Democrats that are very, very weak on or even unsympathetic to, you know, a strong pro-abortion rights position. Bashir embraced that. And so here he ran a campaign that is at least, you know, had some principles to it, I would argue. And then he went for maximum turnout in Louisville and Lexington, the more liberal voting places. He did reach into the suburbs, as they all want to do, and that thing got some movement there. But he went out to those rural counties, talked about health care, talked about wages, and, you know, made his connections out there. And if he had not done one of those things, right, if he hadn't mobilized people who care about abortion rights, if he hadn't mobilized unions, if he hadn't, you know, put resources into a big urban turnout, if he hadn't put resources into, you know, trying to improve his position in suburbia, and if he hadn't gone to those rural counties, when you're winning by 5,000 votes,
yeah,
you skip one of those things, you're probably going to lose. And so my answer on Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, I would say Iowa, which I think is still a place that could shift, and I would, you know, you want to, we talked about a half dozen other states, my answer is do it all with a grounding in principle. Support for economic and social and racial justice, for caring about the planet, saving the planet, and I would argue also for peace. You do that, and then you figure out how to go and talk to a whole bunch of people in a whole bunch of places about it, mobilize them, you win.
Yeah, and as you point out, I mean, in Wisconsin, and maybe not in all of those states, but in Wisconsin and some other places, some of these places that have gone for Trump or have gone for Republicans for the last 8 or 10 years, they used to be Democratic. And if you can go back to them and talk, as you say, health care, unions, those sorts of things, you know, the whole thing that everyone post the 2016 election was saying, you know, was what got Trump elected was the anxious whites, rural whites. Mm-hmm. You can talk to them about real solutions instead of BS.
You can talk to them, but here's one important thing to say. This is important to say. If you've got a rural white guy or an urban, you know, suburban white guy who's been voting Republican since Ronald Reagan, don't pour too much energy into that guy.
No, exactly.
Okay? You know, one of the things to understand about rural, and this is one of my big obsessions, right? One of my big obsessions is don't try and change people who are clearly into a camp. Right. Mm-hmm, don't try and you know, say to that a rural Republican, oh, you got to come over.
Right.
The amount that you have to sacrifice or compromise or just spend to do that is overwhelming.
It's inefficient.
No. But recognize this. Is it that the boom populations in rural areas are Latinx and Asian immigrants?
Yeah.
And that we still have a huge portion of our African-American population that lives in rural areas, predominantly in the South, certainly. You know, and also Native Americans disproportionately living in rural areas. I mean, if you're serious about mobilization, right, many of the models for mobilization tend to be focused so much on urban areas. And that's great because there's a lot of voters there. I do understand, and I think I would never argue against it. But what I'm saying is that there are a lot of potential progressive voters in areas where the Democrats have not paid sufficient attention.
Yeah, yeah.
So again, bottom line before we move to the other thing, bottom line is never sacrifice your principles. Don't, you know, kind of fuzz the margins.
Yeah.
You may try to figure out ways to talk about things that are effective, but stay on principle because it is going to work to sacrifice them. But do take those principles to places where people live, because you're going to find that there's been a lot of neglect of inner cities, of small towns, you know, where, frankly, there's a lot of potential Democratic votes.
Yeah. One thing I will add, and then we're going to talk impeachment, is that for people who say we've got to go get those anxious, fearful white males, the Democratic presidential candidate has won the white, this you probably know this, but most people don't. This is pretty shocking. Has won the white vote once since Kennedy. The white vote. They won it with Lyndon Johnson in 1964.
And by the way, when they won, literally.
That's right. That was a unique election. It was basically dedicated to John Kennedy. But they didn't win it in Kennedy's year, and they haven't won it ever since. They win the presidency. They lose the presidency because the Electoral College, whatever it is, that vote has not been there. So you cannot bank on that, and you've got to know that. And pundits who are railing in the other direction just haven't read history. Okay, impeachment. You make very strongly the point that impeachment is not a constitutional crisis, but a constitutional cure. And you lay out in one article five kind of steps that or guidelines to do it right. Your point that impeachment is a cure goes back to the founders.
That's exactly right. And look, I love impeachment. I just want to tell you right off the bat, I'm an anti-monarchist. I don't like kings and emperors and czars and kaisers and stuff like that. I like to have the people get to choose their leaders. I also like the system of checks and balances, i.e. that, you know, we have rule of law, not the rule of men or women. And as a result, if a leader is elected by the people and turns out to be monarchical, you get to kick them out, right? And impeachment is the protection, to use the terms of the founders. Impeachment is the protection that we establish to guard against elected despotism or a king for 4 years, i.e. that once somebody wins an election, they can do whatever they want. That is not what we fought a revolution for, get rid of King George. And I mean, and again, imperfect people, very imperfect, very flawed. But the one thing they did recognize is that they were imperfect and flawed. And so,
and that one of them might be president in 10 years and turn this way.
Yeah, there's always the guy they didn't like, right? You know, so the end result, though, is that this is a wonderful tool, and it should be applied. It should have been applied in the past. We should have impeached Andrew Johnson. You know, my goodness, that guy deserved it. Bush deserved to be impeached for the lies and wrongdoing as regards the Iraq War. There's no doubt. And frankly, Cheney should have gone, too. And so I'm not one of these people who's like moaning or whining about impeachment. I think it's great, and I think it's a necessary and useful tool. And I think the people are smart enough to sort it out. So I'm glad that finally our Congress is looking at the high crimes and misdemeanors of Donald Trump. Don't make it complicated. Look, the list is endless, right? I know that you could impeach Trump for 150 things. I tend to be a traditionalist in this regard. I like the Peter Rodino approach. You find three good, strong items, enough that people can remember them, but not too many, not overwhelming. I think the three on Trump are pretty well-defined already.
If you would, John, first tell us the three on Nixon, and then that Rodino did put forward that were successful in getting Nixon to resign, and then the three that you suggest on Trump. And then, since I've interrupted you, let me also say, I know you suggest three, and you're going to tell us which three. It doesn't look like they're going that way unless there's something going on. I don't know. So give us the three Nixon, the three Trump, and then your sense of whether we're going to get three.
Well, it's a lot. You put a lot on my table here. So I'm so quick. On Nixon, what Rodino understood, and this is why it's relevant to the outcome sense, what Rodino understood is not everybody would vote for everything, right? So you've got your, you know, just basic lawlessness, the breaking into places and, you know, stuff like that and knowing about it and trying to just corrupt the political process, and there's money and stuff like that. Then there is a second area of seeking to cover that up, right? It's the cover up, right? And then related to that is another area of seeking to obstruct the process. And cover-ups and obstructions, by the way, can be different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a cover-up is you literally just try to hide the fact that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And obstruction is where you threaten people or you refuse to cooperate. And there was a huge amount of that in Watergate. Trump has come up with nothing new. And so each of the items that Rodino had many elements to it, and it would frankly, for the time we've got, it would start to get a little complicated.
No, so that's okay. But I just wanted to tell you that the three areas.
You work in that territory, right? So now we come up. Why did Rodino give you three? Again, it was because he thought that to build a coalition to support articles of impeachment, you would need to have some conservative Democrats. At that time, there were a lot of them, and also a couple Republicans. And not all of them would back the toughest proposals, right? And so you had some softer ones where you could build your coalition on. I liked that approach. And I think having three articles of impeachment is much better, because if you've just got one, and let's say Donald Trump, you know, pulls something out of a hat at the last moment, or some bit of evidence, or at least something that calls things into question, you know, you're stuck with your one, right? Now, I don't think the Ukraine thing is going to fall apart. It looks pretty bad, right? So, emoluments clause. The guy's a crook.
Yep.
Okay? And his family is being enriched, and he's literally trying to hold the G7 at his you know, dumpy resort down in Florida. And, you know, yes, of course, I understand now. He said, oh, I got caught on that. I won't do it. But the fact that he wanted to, that he set out to, and the fact that, you know, plane crews are staying at his resorts in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah.
Pence is, poor Pence is being sent, you know, way out of his way in Ireland to go stay at some Trump resort. I mean, that's it. You got it. The emolument stuff is a breeze. And then finally, we draw back from the Mueller report, which, you know, I mean, the Mueller report had some strengths, some weaknesses. But the obstruction stuff is, you know, I mean, it's undebatable. You know, this guy did try to cover up and obstruct. He literally tried to thwart investigations into what he was doing. He fired the head of the FBI.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then went on national television and said, I fired him because I was concerned about this investigation.
Yeah.
Just paraphrasing. So those would be my three. And then you got three legs and of a stool. And if most Democrats would probably vote for all three of those without a problem. But if you get if by chance you get a Republican or so, or a few over on an obstruction because they just are rule of law people, or on the emolument stuff because it's so clear, or they're national security folks and they go for the Ukraine stuff.
Yeah. But one thing I've heard you say in the past also is that you sort of can frame it all as corruption. Corruption.
Cheating.
Yeah. Well, no. The way that I often say it is cheating, because I've got so much more personal than corruption, you know?
Yeah, a lot of us
aren't corrupt. We don't get affected by corruption, but a lot of us get cheated out of stuff. We know how that feels.
I like self-dealing.
Yeah.
It just sounds sophisticated. But I also like using the term crook. Okay. Because, you know, Richard Nixon really hated that. You know, you need another president isn't a crook. I think it's fair to get comfortable with it.
Yeah.
You know, some things are crooked.
Yep.
And the root of the word, you know, root of crooked is crook.
Yep.
And so we shouldn't hesitate to be rather blunt in our language. I know some people want to be more polite and officious about this, and I really have respect for system of checks and balances. But I also think that, you know, some realistic language here is not a bad thing.
Well, because you got to sway the public, because you got to sway the public to sway the legislators.
Yeah, and so that's so you got step one there. You got your three, right? My second step is don't let it go forever, right? You know, if you're telling people there's an urgent need to impeach the president of the United States, do it on a pretty quick timeline. You don't have to race through. You have to dot your I's, cross your T's, take it seriously. But don't be
But it seems like they're with you on this one, in that in the places where they have proven themselves willing to forego evidence if it might involve a court challenge, because the courts is something which Trump has shown very, very adept at dragging out. So even though there's some evidence they'd like to have, they aren't, you know, that they've asked for and they aren't getting, they seem to be saying we're not going to go to court because that'll slow things down.
That's right. And I think that's important. I think that's smart. You know, don't be cautious about this stuff. Do it, you know, if you're ready to impeach, don't say, oh, I got to go find some judge to tell me it's okay.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you got the material, and so they're holding some piece of paper back, say, okay, and we need this paper by this day. If you don't give it to us,
we got enough.
That, We'll add that to the obstruction.
That's right. That's right. Anything you don't give us, instead of going to court and dragging things on, just adds to the obstruction side, even if we don't make an obstruction claim. What is your sense? Because it does look to me like so far it seems like they're just going on the Ukraine, and we've got basically 1 minute, John.
Yeah, don't just do one thing. Like I said, I do think they tend to be focused on it, and it is the gift that keeps on giving. There's no question.
Yeah.
It does appear that folks want to rat this guy out. More power to him. I would just say one final thing on the Ukraine. Don't get lost on the incredible complexity of some of this stuff. Stay on the core reality of what Trump has already acknowledged.
Right.
Because what he's acknowledged is incredibly damning.
Yep. And the one other thing that I will say, because I've heard you say it in other interviews and write about it, is whether something is a crime or not, which is a defense they will make, is not crucial here. This is not a criminal trial. When the founders set it up, they didn't say we have to be able to get presidents out when they commit crimes. It said we have to get presidents out when they begin to become unjust presidents, when they begin
Because it's about the office.
That's right.
It's and not things, about the individual.
Things that you or I would do that wouldn't matter when a president does them.
That's exactly right. So, and one quick final element on this, for what it's worth, and that is, this is the way to distinguish between the legal and the political. This is a political act, and it should be a political act because you are undoing an election, right? You are saying that we want to replace this guy and that his sins against the Republic, against the Constitution, against his abuses of office are sufficient, that he needs to go now. We can't wait till the next election.
Mm-hmm.
There is a sense of urgency about that, but it's not a trial. And the important thing to understand is this: if in a legal circumstance, if you're convicted of doing wrong, you may go to jail. You may be fined. There's all sorts of, you know, clear penalties. Impeachment, all that happens is you're out.
Yeah.
So it really is about repairing or protecting the office.
Yeah.
And we have to keep our eye on that because this obsession with the individual or with, you know, the personal side of it. Yeah, I understand that's why you removed the person because they did bad stuff. But your reason for removing them is to make sure that they do not continue to do damage to the Republic using the most powerful office in the land. It is, as George Mason said, the answer to the question, what do we do about the person who occupies the office that allows them, and this is paraphrase, that allows them to do the most damage?
Yeah.
If we cannot remove that person when they are doing damage, we run the risk that the Republic itself will be harmed in ways that are irreparable.
Yeah. And he even said this is be the answer to questions such as, and this is Mason's words, shall any man be above justice?
Yeah.
This is going right back to, is Trump above the law? No one is above the law, as Pelosi said when she finally came out for impeachment. Okay, we got to close now. Great stuff, John. So again, we referenced the 2006 book, The Genius of Impeachment. You can look for John's frequent articles in The Nation and at thenation.com and listen to his podcast, Next Left, which you can find on all sorts of podcast sites as well as at thenation.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at Nichols Uprising. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. That's TerrenceMcNally.net or one word, a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements that tells you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about and usually 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and just about every other podcast site you use. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at these other sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell and Teddy Robinson in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Thank you, John Nichols. Keep up the good work.
I'm honored to be with you.
As the PV audience has grown, so have our bandwidth costs. We've tried to protect the limited commercial nature of the stream, so to keep up with the costs, we need your help. You might say we're victims of our own success. With nearly a million regular listeners now, the cost of operating the stream has grown beyond our wildest expectations. If you want to continue enjoying all the great shows on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, please pitch in now. Go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button.